from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Race still matters in America, but the country's color lines are moving. Tonight, we address the new dynamics of race in America with two top national leaders in the African-American and Latino communities, Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, and Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. What is changing in race relations? What is not? And what does it mean for you? Coming up on Point, Julian Bond and Antonia Hernandez on race and the American future. We begin in Iraq, where today's powerful car bombing in the holy city of Najaf killed a top Iraqi Shiite leader and left at least 75 dead. I spoke earlier with Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. I asked him to describe Iraqi reaction to the bombing.
Well, I think most Iraqis are really in shock over this. They're stuck to their television screens. They're watching what's going on unfold down there. They can't believe this death toll of more than 80, and they can't believe either that Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim has also passed away in this. So I think that for them, this is really raising the level of tension and the level of what is possible in Iraq.
From everything I'm reading, this sounds like the Shiites' equivalent of Vatican City, of St. Peter's, where the big bomb went off.
That's right. There's no question that in the pantheon of all the holy places in Shiite Islam, this is the most important. It's the most holy. It's the one that's the most revered. I mean, in Najaf and around on the edges of it is a huge, a vast, vast cemetery where Shia come from all over the Islamic world. Their bodies are brought after they've died to be buried here because it seemed to be a very, very holy thing. And it's one of the reasons, the fact that the bomb went off here, that it seems that the people are not really pointing the finger at fellow Shia. They don't think that this is a Shia upon Shia battle, but that more likely they were really remnants of the old regime who were probably behind this and really just trying to sow chaos and trouble.
Who would, as people sit down to analyze this, be seen as benefiting from this blast, these deaths?
There's no doubt that there has been a political tussle that's been going on between kind of the two main Shiite camps. And the one Ayatollah al-Hakim's group, Skiri, is the group that really has signed off on supporting or at least cooperating with the U.S.-led occupational authority. I mean, Ayatollah al-Hakim's brother, Abdulaziz, he is a sitting member of the governing council that was appointed by the United States. Of course, more than half the members of that are Shiite Muslims, because, of course, more than half of Iraqis, almost 60%, are Shiite Muslims. So they decided that they would play a role in that. Although I met Ayatollah al-Hakim for an interview just a few weeks ago, and he was making it clear to me the reason why they did accept to play a role, because they wanted to basically help end the American occupation as soon as possible. And the way they felt that was easiest to do that was to ensure that there was an Iraqi government that could take over.
Scott, you put this in terms of potential Ba'athists, that is Saddam Hussein's party, behind this. Yet I wonder if, looking forward, if Iraq is going to go forward towards some kind of new power structure, maybe even elections, might this be simply an act of civil war of Sunni upon Shia?
Well, I think that that can be a contributing factor. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but I don't think that you'd find anywhere near that kind of depth of emotion among most Sunnis or most Shia. I mean, certainly those who perpetrated this act would have felt that they were trying to sow as much chaos, as much sense of pending civil war and doom as possible, at the same time showing that that the United States is not in control, that they cannot maintain security in these areas or anywhere in Iraq. So all of this is kind of part of the game plan, it seems, of those who want to undermine. And you're right to point out, it's not always pro-Ba'ath, pro-former regime, pro-Saddam Hussein. A lot of it also is anti-American. What we don't know is how long they're going to be able to continue this, and or whether or not even if Saddam Hussein were captured or killed, whether that would make a difference.
And what about among the Shiite themselves? There's 60% of Iraq's, 24 million people in this very same mousque. Just a day after Saddam's ouster, a mob hacked a major Shiite leader to death. There has been a fairly clear split between some of the more traditional and senior leaders and this new young Sheikh Muqtada al-Sadr in Baghdad. How is this likely to ripple through the internal politics of the Shia community?
This is going to kind of deepen those questions, if you will, because, of course, while Ayatollah al-Hakim's group And the majority of Iraq's Shia seem to be cooperating, if only slightly, with the occupation authorities. Muqtada al-Sadr's group has really been interested in ending the American occupation immediately, like tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of where that line has been drawn. It's not been ideological as much as it's been political. Of course, Muqtada al-Sadr is coming from a long line of famous Iraqi clerics, but he is very, very young. He doesn't have the kind of religious ranking anywhere near that Ayatollah al-Hakim had, but still, his group is believed to have been responsible for killing rival clerics in the past. So this certainly isn't going to improve the situation for them.
In other areas today, another U.S. serviceman died in an ambush, 6 others wounded, 1 we're told likely to lose his leg. Paul Bremer said today that this bombing demonstrated that the enemies of the new Iraq will stop at nothing. How do you think this is likely to affect the Iraqi view, the Shiite view of the American presence?
Well, this is a good question, and my understanding in my visits to Najaf and Karbala is that American forces in those areas, though they are there and in control, keep an extremely low profile. I spent 2 days in Najaf a few weeks ago. I saw 1 American convoy on the streets, which is remarkable compared to the profile that you see of American forces in Baghdad and other places. And I think that their attitude is that, by and large, you know, the people here accept that they are here in those southern areas. They accept that the Americans are there, and therefore there's no particular need to show force. On the one hand, and on the other hand, the Shia often do quite a good job in policing themselves, if you will. They have their own networks, they have their own systems, and because the cultural gap is so wide between Americans and Iraq's Shia community, often the two sides try and keep their distance. And in this case, of course, because this kind of attack occurred, there will be some criticism. Why wasn't there a more apparent American security presence? But that same kind of presence often in the past has proved to be provocative. So in this sense, the U.S. forces are really in a catch-22.
Scott Peterson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Baghdad. When new Census Bureau figures out early this year showed Latinos have overtaken African Americans as the country's largest minority group, the curtain was lifted on the dynamic racial map of a new century. Some saw black-Latino conflict, some saw black-Latino common cause. Everyone saw American color lines in motion, and they're going to keep moving. Tonight on Point, old challenges and new realities in American race relations. What does it mean that Latinos are now the largest minority? That whites now ponder being a minority too? When black Americans say, let's not forget core issues in a dynamic century, what path are we on? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP. Good evening and welcome, Julian Bond.
Thank you for having me.
And also Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Wonderful to have you, Antonia Hernandez.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's an honor to have either of you. To have you both is a real opportunity, and we want to make the most of it tonight. Julian Bond, 100 years ago this year, or coming on it, W.E. Du Bois said that the color line would be the problem of the 20th century. Is it also the problem? Will it also be the problem of the 21st century? Or are we somehow moving past the color line?
I wish I could say that we were, but of course it's still a tremendous problem in America. And Dr. Du Bois said many years later that behind the problem of color was the problem of unequal distribution of wealth and resources. These two problems have plagued the United States for centuries. The problem of race continues to plague the United States in the 21st century, and I only hope that when the next one dawns, that there won't be on some future program of this sort people talking about it again.
Let me put the same question to you, Antonio Hernandez. Du Bois saw it as the defining problem of the 20th century. As a Latino leader, do you see race as the defining problem of this century that we have now entered?
It is still going to be a challenging issue, and I think it's going to be much more complex and complicated, because 100 years ago you were talking about in the United States, a black-white world. And now the 21st century is a century of many colors, mm-hmm. of many communities. And it's not just the color line, but also, you know, the different hues of that color, and immigration playing a much more a central role. I truly believe that the challenge for this country in the 21st century is the challenge that its demographics are changing dramatically. And what impact will that have on American society?
We want to really look at that tonight. Julian Bond, let me put it to you. I read one columnist saying that what the American majority does best when it comes to the black question is to change the subject, and that maybe the whole issue of black, Latino, minority, who's larger, is changing the subject. But at the same time, just after those numbers came out earlier this year, we heard Henry Louis Gates saying, African Americans and the African American leadership community are about to enter an identity crisis, the extent of which we have not begun to imagine. Our privileged status is about to be disrupted in profound ways. And he was talking there about the emergence of this large new Latino minority. How do you see the significance of this shift? It's just a number, and yet it is a number.
Well, it's more than a number. I see it as a growing group of allies joining an old fight. Allies who were here in past years, their numbers growing in this year's. I know and respect Dr. Gates, but I disagree profoundly with that statement. African Americans have a privileged status only in the sense that we've been the problem child and the problem that America won't deal with. I'm happy to have others join that status. I'm happy to have the numbers grow.
Are you confident that the Latino community, which has a different take on race, a different kind of complexity of racial landscape, I guess, one might say, than the black community, are you confident that they will be allies?
By and large, yes, I am confident. You know, Ms. Hernandez and I are here in Boston to attend a conference, and one of the panels on the conference is an examination of Latino attitudes toward African Americans, mm-hmm. toward Caucasians, and it'll be interesting to see what that panel suggests. What I think they're going to say is that, generally speaking, and this is an enormous generalization, that Hispanics, Latinos are going to be strong allies in the fight for social justice. They have been in the past, they will be in the future, and while not every Latino nor every African American believes in the same thing, sufficient numbers of each group do to make this a more powerful minority.
Antonio Hernandez, your view on that. The census figures may have changed in part because for the first time in 2000, as I understand it, respondents could describe themselves both as a minority and as white, more than one category, and many Hispanics did that. What does that mean? I'm reading some people saying, well, are Latinos going to be follow the path of white immigration? On the other hand, here's a great wag saying, granted, coming from Ciudad Juarez isn't the same as coming from County Cork, but anything is better than coming up from slavery. Do you see Latinos embracing the racial challenge, as the country has known it, as their own?
Well, first and foremost, you started this conversation with speaking about race and color line. And what it says is that it's not so much what we think of ourselves, and I will speak to that. It's what you think of me and what you see in me. And what American society, white American society, see in us, to the degree that Latinos color the entire color hue, and as we are as diverse as can be, but we have black Latinos, we have, you know, the majority of us, like myself, are a mixture of Spanish and Indian. Mm-hmm. And so the question is still one of race. If you look at me and see someone that doesn't belong here, someone is a second-class citizen, then the color of race and the history that this country has with how it sees race, those stereotypes are going to be applied to us.
But doesn't your own attitude make a difference as well? We've seen this recent, very recent poll numbers out showing quite optimistic, relatively speaking, views on the part of Latinos toward life and their prospects in the United States. Doesn't that make a difference as well?
Oh, absolutely. And we as a community are a very optimistic community. But nonetheless, as you look at particularly, well, first let me say, you know, Latinos are a very diverse group.
Antonia Hernandez, if you'll be good enough to hold it there, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight with Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and Julian Bond, chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. You can join this conversation as well. Do you see a new vista of race and race relations ahead in this century? What does it look like? Or are the issues unchanging? This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about black power, Latino power, and the new face of American race and race relations in the 21st century. You can join the conversation tonight. What does it mean when Latinos are the largest minority, when we can foresee whites as less than a majority? Do you see conflict and tension between ethnic groups in your community, or do you see cooperation? And what do you want to ask these top leaders of the black and Latino communities in America? My guest tonight, Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, and Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And it is great to have you both, especially in this week, when we spent a lot of time this week looking back, of course, to 40 years ago and the events in August 1963. We had John Lewis on the show and Randall Kennedy and many attendees at that 1963 March on Washington. Julian Bond, with all of that background music in this week, which is playing in your ears like it is in the ears of all of us, what's your thought as we sit here at the end of this month in this 40th anniversary of where the country has come and where it has still to go?
Well, despite undeniable progress, the country still has a long, long distance to go. And if you look just at black and white, if you look at the difference in life chances, life expectancy, median family income, years of education, and on and on and on, there's still enormous gaps. In fact, if you look at just one figure, unemployment rate, the difference between black and white unemployment is as great today as it was when Dr. King made that speech 40 years ago. And so despite Colin Powell, despite Condoleezza Rice, despite black faces in high places, there are still these enormous achievement gaps between majority and minority Americans. And that's the unfinished business. That's the unfulfilled dream. That's the unfulfilled promise that Dr. King spoke about 40 years ago.
And what's the path toward the resolution of that core, that unfulfilled promise? And are we on that path?
You know, America's always had a civil rights movement, and it's always had people of every race and ethnicity in it. And that movement has pursued its goals through agitation, litigation, coalition, all of the standard ways people try to improve their conditions. And I anticipate that we're just going to see more of that in the future. Now, of course, this is a very, very different world. You're absolutely right. When Dr. King made that speech, this was a black-white world. Mm-hmm. At least so we thought it was. It wasn't then, but we thought it was. Mm-hmm. It's now very, very different. When I look at the students I teach, they're very different from students I would have taught 40 years ago. When I look at people on the street, they're very different from people I would have seen on the street 40 years ago. And unless we understand that and embrace that and try to make some progress from that, then 40 years from now we'll be having other anniversaries and worrying, where's the dream going?
What about those students that you teach? Do they see the world through the same lenses as students one might have taught 40 years ago or even 20 years ago? I mean, we see, despite all the continuing lines that are there, we see all kinds of examples of diversity now as well. How has it changed the perception of young black Americans of the racial challenge?
Well, they are lucky enough to have grown up in a country where the laws protected them from overt discrimination. They're fortunate enough, if they're white, to have never turned on their evening news and seen people fire-hosed as they would have seen in 1963. And when they're confronted with racial discrimination, they sometimes have a great deal of difficulty dealing with it, unlike, I think, my generation that grew up expecting it and knowing that it was everywhere. But nonetheless, I think they may, and this is a leap, I think they may be more firmly committed to creating a truly diverse America with populations of people of color and people without color spread all up and down throughout the spectrum, equally distributed, and not some groups shuttled away and some groups having to accept second-class citizenship. I think these young people are more committed to that, in fact, than their predecessors mm-hmm. would have been 40 years ago.
Because
they've grown up with it, they've lived it, they've seen it in their schools, they even see it on TV. They live in a very different world than I did when I was there.
They presume it to some degree that it should be true.
Yes,
for them,
they do.
And will be. Antonio Hernandez, I'm looking here at July labor statistics out, and here we see the very unemployment figures that Julian Bond's talking about, high for both African-Americans and Hispanics, 11.1% for black adults, 8.2% for Hispanics, far above the national average on both counts. Yet, you were talking about attitudes before, and we see this Time CBS News poll out just earlier in August that showed markedly higher optimism on the part of Latinos. For example, 64% of Latinos, among a very large survey here, saying there was no specific instance when they felt discriminated against because of their ethnicity. This compared to, 25% of African Americans. Also, very high percentages of African Americans saying that life will be better for their next generation, their families, than it is for them. How do you look at this? Of course, many Latinos are immigrants. Is this kind of a dewy-eyed naivete, or is it gung-ho in a way that will work for the Latino community?
Well, first and foremost, as you indicated, the Latino community is very diverse, and you have a substantial percentage that are immigrants, and immigrants from whatever part of the world come in extremely enthusiastic about the system. In fact, if you look at some polls and you look closely at other polls, it shows that the second generation of those immigrants begin to then become much more, less optimistic about their future. And the key to the Latino community and other communities is really education and employment. Even when an African American or a Latino has the same education, you know, has the same professional credentials, there is still discrimination in the workplace. Education is, you know, the key in our community for upward mobility, and it's an issue that has challenged poor communities, particularly Latino and African American. For our community, I can tell you mm-hmm. that the key challenge for us mm-hmm. is educating our youth and making sure that they are able to join the mainstream. And the biggest challenge is that Latinos have the highest dropout rate. This country still has an inability to educate immigrants, and particularly poor immigrants, because you're not only talking about ethnicity, you're talking about language, you're talking about immigrant status. And to the degree that you work and you we have the largest concentration of working people, mm-hmm. but they're the working poor.
Mm-hmm.
They're the minimum wage.
And I'm looking here at a new report just out a week ago or so in the Wall Street Journal, saying Hispanic immigrants are piling into the labor market and weighing down the wages. This is the lead, weighing down the wages of all workers in a broad range of blue-collar occupations. Now, we know they don't want to do that. That's no fun. Nobody wants to have lower wages. But Julian Bond, when you're out talking to your membership, you're presenting a vision of cooperation here, of arm in arm. But is that the way it's seen in the street? I mean, I'm reading here tension in some communities around the country saying, gosh, our jobs are going to immigrants. You know, God love them, but it's driving wages down. This doesn't feel good.
Well, you know, it's interesting that there's always been this tension between the newcomer and the established.
Of course.
And it was true when the newcomer was Irish. And it's true when the newcomer is from Mexico or from El Salvador. But there are also remarkable instances of cooperation between the newcomer and the long-established and the other populations. There's a long, long history in Texas, for example, of Hispanic-black cooperation in political struggles back in the 1940s and the 1950s. There's long instances of cooperation between these groups in other parts of the country. And today, within the NAACP, we look in Colorado, mm-hmm. we look in Texas, look in California. We're fond of saying in the NAACP that in the National Association for the Advancement of color people come in all colors, and anybody who shares our values is more than welcome. We've worked long and hard with a variety of groups, MALDEF for one, LULAC for another.
This is Antonio Hernandez's group, MALDEF. Mm-hmm.
And try to inculcate in all of our members, most of whom are African-American, the great majority of whom are African-American, that we cannot fight this fight by ourselves. We have never fought this fight by ourselves. We can't afford to fight this fight by ourselves. We've got to reach out to other communities. And wherever we run into someone who shares our condition, even if they don't share our color, we want to make common cause with them.
And is that message resonating with your membership, with the African-American community?
I think it does. I think it does. I think people realize that, you know, it's one person can't do it, two people might, three surely can, and we'd be fools to ignore this growing population of new soldiers in this fight.
And let me tell you that I think there is tension, no question about it. But considering the circumstances in which these communities come together, it is really not. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. Watts, South Central Los Angeles, which was predominantly an African-American community, being transformed and changed into a Latino community.
Famously an African-American community and recently an African-American community.
Exactly. And what do you have? You have poor people with the fewest resources, worse schools, bad, you know, housing, competing for precious jobs and housing and conditions, living together.
So potential pressure cooker here.
Exactly. And you don't see that often. And when you do see it, you highlight the tension. That's not to say that it's not there. But
let's look at the coexistence and more than that that goes on day in and day out.
Exactly. And the understanding. And poor people understand other poor people and what they go through. And I believe that there's a lot more in common, and it's up to the leadership to build on those commonalities, which I think we do quite a bit and quite well, and a better understanding. I mean, you know, one of the things that we try to work with in our community is when we say understand American society, not just white America, but Black America, and the richness of history of Black America. At the same time, not all of us are immigrants. There are 16 generation Latinos, and yet we're painted with that broad brush of everyone being Latino. What is a Latino? What is a Hispanic, Cuban, Mexican-American, Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens?
What is a minority at some point in this century?
And in Los Angeles, where I come from, the largest concentrations of Koreans, Iranians, of people from every part of the world. And the key for this country is going to be how do we all learn to live together.
We're talking tonight with Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, about race and the American future. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, and a lot of people want to do that. I want to turn to them. Ronald is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Ronald. You're on the air.
Hello. Good show. I'm loving it. I wish both guests would comment on the relationship between race and ethnicity. They are overlapping concepts, but they're not interchangeable and synonymous. For example, Antonio said that some Latinos are Black. Well, that is a critical fact, and I think that both groups have a broad range of diversity. And I wish the guests would comment on how race and ethnicity overlap.
It's a great point, especially in this century. And Antonio Hernandez, let me turn first to you. When you think about the facts on the ground today, the future that's coming toward us, as a Latino leader, how do you parse these words, these concepts, race, ethnicity? Where do you see all of this going? Are these going to remain the great pillars of American thinking about, and how do they interact?
Well, actually, you know, within our community, we don't talk that much about color because we understand our diversity. I mean, you talk about a Dominican from the Caribbean, a Puerto Rican. You talk about a Mexican, you know, from Veracruz. You know, we acknowledge that culture, religion, language play a very important role in our lives. The question I would throw back to folks is that the issue of race will continue to be an issue so long as white America continues to have the stereotypes and beliefs that it has. And let me give you an example. Yes, I was born in Mexico, but I came here in 1956 when I was a child. Today, people still say, where did you come from? And when I say Los Angeles, they say, no, no, really.
Really?
And until somebody looks at me and sees an American, that's the day that I will know that race is no longer, ethnicity is no longer a factor. And for me, it doesn't matter whether it's race or ethnicity. The impact is the same. I'm not an American.
Julian Bond, speak to the same question, if you would. Race, ethnicity, this very diverse century that we're headed into.
Well, in a way, I want to say that we don't want ethnicity to go away. You know, on March 17th, every year we celebrate St. Patrick's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And even those of us who are not Irish celebrate and
break out
try
the green.
To have a good time.
Yes.
We wear the green. In fact, I even got married on St. Patrick's Day, so the whole world would celebrate my marriage. So we don't want it to disappear. We value it. We want to celebrate it. We believe very strongly that the people who've made up this country brought something valuable with them, and that something is worth all of us celebrating whenever we can. And we want them to be able to celebrate it as they will. But Antonia is absolutely right. When people stop looking at me and characterizing me because of the way I look rather than who I am, then we will have gotten past this, but not until then.
What about the white American population in a century where they're very standing as a majority race, if we can even call it that as things move forward, eventually goes away. Sometime mid-century, there's many forecasts, it will. Julian Bond, how do you see white America responding? Already in many cities and regions across the country, there's a very different mix, and white Americans are not in the majority. What's the response you see to that so far? What do you anticipate the response will be in the decades that we're now moving into?
Well, you know, we all know that race has absolutely no biological significance. There are more differences within races than there are between races. So we know race has no real biological significance, but we also know—
And yet politically, know, economically,
yes,
sociologically—
it has every significance. It isn't a pigment of our imagination. Mm. It's a real fact of life, and it carries enormous weight. And if you're of the wrong race— then that enormous weight falls on you, and it's reflected in high rates of unemployment, in poor schools, in the worst neighborhoods, in the least amount of police protection, in all of the standard measures by which we see thrust upon minorities in this country. So that's the real challenge.
But do you see new openness as the numbers equalize, or do you see backlash?
I see both things. In California right now, there's a proposition on the ballot which is reflective of this backlash. It attempts to stop the state of California from counting or analyzing data by race. To many people, this is attractive. Why should we check these little boxes? Why should we pigeonhole ourselves?
We're through with all that.
But in fact, if we don't have this information, we won't be able to track disparate rates of ill health for different groups of people. We won't know, for example, that white women are more at risk for breast cancer than any other women in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't these women know this? Why shouldn't they be able to seek treatment? Why shouldn't they be able to do whatever they can to ensure their good health? So what sounds like a good idea is actually an awful idea, but it's reflective of the tendency, I think, of many in the majority community to want to say, let's put these things behind us, let's forget it. Dr. King took care of that 40 years ago. It's not a problem. At least it doesn't bother me.
And there will surely be much more temptation in that direction in this century of a very dynamic racial map in America. We're talking tonight with Julian Bond, chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and Antonia Hernandez, president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. You can join the conversation. What do you want to ask these top leaders of the Black and Latino communities in America? Where are race relations headed in this country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about race and the American future with Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, and Antonia Hernandez, president of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Nick is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. you know, one of the things that can, you know, while on the one hand, you know, I'm delighted when I walk around in New York or, you know, some more mixed parts of Boston mm-hmm. to see how things are changing, one of the things that concerns me, though, is that most of the majority population really can't deal with any of these questions in their subtleties. And in a sense, if it isn't black and white, a lot of things simply aren't comprehended. So, you know, people will, like if I talk about
what are you saying, Nick, that anything in between turns it into a muddle? Is it?
Yes, in a sense, yes. And while, you know, as a black American and as a lot of other non-white Americans grow up dealing with all sorts of ways of working with ethnic and racial questions, a lot of white Americans don't. And so if there isn't a stark, you know, in-your-face kind of problem, if there's something that requires something more than a soundbite to describe it, a lot of people just simply never get it.
Nick, let us pick it up right there. Julian Bond, is it possible that somehow the whole issue of race is going to get lost in a welter of rainbow colors and evaporate, at least in the minds of white Americans?
I don't think so. You know, white Americans live more segregated lives than do racial minorities.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the census data, the average white city or suburban dweller lives in a community that is overwhelmingly white, and that is not true of any other group of people in the United States. What this means is that this population has relatively little to do with these other populations, doesn't know them, doesn't see them, doesn't live with them, doesn't work with them, and because of that, is likely to harbor these kind of stereotypical notions that's a bad person when I see a person different than I am.
Is this century going to force a change in that, or is it going to lead to tighter white enclaves?
I think it may at least initially lead to tighter. Now, I'm an optimist. I believe these things are going to all work themselves out in the end. I'm not sure when the end's going to be. But I think in the short run, the very short run, we're likely to see more separation rather than less. And the separation, remember, the separation is white-driven. It's not a question of these minorities huddling together or being them, you know, sticking only with themselves or sitting at the same table in the dining room. The real question, why are all the whites sitting by themselves?
Well, there's one to ponder, especially as this century rolls ahead. Pam is calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment. You know, there's something that often gets left out in this discussion of diversity, which we see a lot about in the media.
Okay.
And that is that this country, at the same time that it's becoming more diverse, is also growing in terms of population. The United States now has the fastest rate of population growth of any of the industrialized countries. Between 1990 and 2000, the population increased.
A lot of new babies and a lot of immigrants. Is that where you're headed here, Pam?
Part of it is due to, it depends on what statistics you read. I've heard anywhere from between a third to a half of current population growth in the United States is due to immigration.
So take us to your point.
My point is that I don't have an issue with diversity, but what concerns me is, you know, what this country is going to look like in the year 2050, when we're expected to have a population of nearly 4,000 people.
4,000 or 400 million. When you say what it looks like, do you mean the color of the country or the crowding of the country?
The color
Are you sure?
About the loss of open space, increased traffic.
Pam, is this a backdoor way of saying there are too many Latinos, or you're just saying it's going to be too crowded?
I'm saying that it's going to be too crowded. I don't care about the mix, but it does concern me.
Pam, our time is short. Antonia Hernandez, I want to put that right to you. What do you hear when you hear Pam's comment?
Well, first of all, the fastest growth is in the state of Utah, and it's the Mormon community, and they're white. So it's not Latinos. Number two,
There are also immigrants there.
There is, and in fact, you know, a growing number of immigrants, because the Mormons have gone throughout the world to proselytize and bring
and haven't stayed home and well okay.
and are here. But I mean, as far as let me tell you that it is a benefit, outright benefit, that the United States is growing. The biggest problem Japan and a lot of industrial nations, such as Italy and a whole bunch of others, is their loss of population and, in fact, the fact that they're shrinking. Now, mind you, I'm not proposing massive growth, but that is not as big of a challenge in this country. And to the degree that people attribute the growth to a bunch of brown babies goes back to my issue that this country still has a whole bunch of issues to deal with, dealing with race.
Around color. Julian Bond, what about this immigration issue? As an African-American leader, our time is short, but shall the gates stay open? Is it good for black Americans? Is it not?
Of course it's good. I mean, the immigrant population enriches us all. They do jobs that others don't want to do. They pay taxes. They support the country. They're an enormous asset to us. They've enriched us enormously. And now we've got an immigrant running for the governor of California. So you see what promise this country has. Anyone can come here and succeed. I'd be dead set against shutting the door or limiting the door or closing the door.
Well, a note of optimism as we set off into a very complex new century, and we're very grateful to both of you for being here tonight to help us look into that future. Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Antonia Hernandez, president of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, unearthing America's relationship with the cosmos. This is On Point. This week, Mars brushed as close to the Earth as it has been in 60,000 years. On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors says the red planet and space in general have always captured the American imagination, in part because of the country's tendency to tell its story in terms of the future, not the past. Tonight, Ned Connors digs up an audio history of America's vision of the extraterrestrial.
In 1963, Bill Bixby welcomed a Martian into his living room. He moved in. No big cultural adjustments. Perhaps Uncle Martin was in good company among 20th century Americans. Tocqueville observed it in the 1830s, just a few generations removed from the Revolution. Americans were a hurried, edgy people, little concerned with their past. Late in the 19th century, flush with the mix of terror and excitement of the new industrial world, we began to create a mythology not of the past, but of the future. Earthbound fantasies of Puritan cities on the hill gave way to new, decidedly secular, extraterrestrial worlds. As those fantasies took on cinematic or televised form in the 20th century, we needed soundtracks. In the 1920s, Soviet scientist Leon Theremin gave birth to a radio-inspired instrument you didn't even have to touch. The artist stood in an electromagnetic field and with precise hand movements produced otherworldly musical sounds. In 1947, Dr. Samuel Hoffman, a former chiropodist and America's leading cinematic thereminist, was paired up with composer Harry Revel on a West Coast session released as Music Out of the Moon. This was the first of a new genre, space music. Here's Hoffman with the Leslie Baxter Orchestra on a cut from that album, Celestial Nocturne. The music of the future would have a harp, vocal chorus, and the ethereal sound of the theremin. But futuristic music didn't have to be about space. Sometimes it gave a nod to our past. In 1955, RCA released an experimental box set of 45s introducing the electronic music synthesizer. Here's an RCA engineer's completely programmed version of an Earthbound Stephen Foster melody. The same year that RCA introduced their synthesizer, the voices of Walter Schumann, who also had a hit in 1955 with Disney's Ballad of Davy Crockett, recorded the choral space music to Leith Stevens' narrated journey to Venus, exploring the unknown. I think when Gene Roddenberry was dreaming up Star Trek, someone gave him a copy of this album.
140 days out from Earth, and how close ahead is Venus, planet of mystery, guarding her secrets beneath the dazzling white cloak of bright clouds. This is the new frontier. What lies behind those clouds? Is there life? And if there be life, what manner of living things will we encounter?
A dozen years later, we began a journey where no television audience had gone before. Star Trek, ostensibly about space, spoke more to American hopes and anxieties in the 60s. Racial and gender equality, the Cold War. From the deck of the Enterprise, it seemed a reasonable idea that the entire universe could be persuaded to adopt American principles of democracy, justice, and expensive gadgetry. Star Trek's theme music drew its inspiration from the stark, dreamy space music of the 50s. Composer Alexander Courage gave us a hybrid future music, the whooshing of the Enterprise backed by a theremin-sounding female chorus. Seizing on the popularity of the series, Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock, released music from outer space during the show's second season. Much of the album is Nimoy narrating and the character of Spock, but a few instrumentals are tucked in. Here's the Star Trek theme as we might have heard it in a space discotheque. Voyaging from the sublime to the ridiculous. In 1960, Hanna-Barbera scored an unexpected hit in network television's first animated series, The Flintstones, kind of a Cro-Magnon honeymooners. 2 years later, they tried the same idea, but this time in the future. If a Stone Age suburban sitcom worked, why not move the suburbs way up? The show's theme was written by Hoyt Curtin, Hanna-Barbera's musical director. Gone was the solemnity and mystery of space. The future was slapstick. A nuclear family, galactic capitalism, and the ultimate in detached housing. And the future had bongos. It would be brassy and a little neurotic.
Jane, his wife.
In the late 70s came Star Wars, the next epic in America's extraterrestrial mythology. What were they playing on the bandstand of an intergalactic cantina? What did we listen to? Not in the future, but in some remote futuristic past. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, barroom music sounded a little like Benny Goodman turned inside out and played on steel drum. Uncle Martin would have felt right at home.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.